From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Barack Obama wants CEOs to be more accountable for how they run their companies and how they affect the economy. The Illinois senator and Democratic presidential candidate is pushing a bill that gives shareholders a say on the salaries that CEOs make. And big business bailouts make for big controversy. For more, we have economist Keith Reed. He is a reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer and writes a finance blog for BET called Dollar Out of 15 Cents. Hello, Keith.
Hey, Tom.
Let's talk about Barack Obama's say-on-pay legislation. It was introduced in 2007, but he referenced it again just this past Friday. What's his intention with this bill?
Well, the bill is actually a companion to a measure that actually just passed in the House a couple of weeks ago. And what say-on-pay really means is that shareholders would have the to vote on some of the compensation packages that CEOs are paid. What happens currently in corporate America is that every board of directors has a compensation committee. That committee is made up of members of the board. That board will then determine what the compensation package will be for the board itself, and also for the top executives at the company, including CEO, and then the full board will vote on the compensation package that the compensation committee approves. That is the way that it works most of the time in corporate America, with obviously the intention being that the board of directors is voting by proxy as representatives of the shareholders. This measure would give the shareholders themselves a little bit more direct control over, or at least a little bit more scrutiny, some checks and balances over what the CEOs are paid.
Isn't this a tricky legal position, given the fact that many in this country don't want the government to have more control over private industry?
But I don't think that this measure gives the government any more control over private industry. I think what it does is just put, or at least what it aims to do, is put more control in the hands of the shareholders. The shareholders are the ones who are making, who are voting with their own dollars, making investments in companies. And as it stands now, many of them don't have a direct say over whether or not or how much a CEO gets paid. They don't have a direct say in approving some of these golden parachutes that we hear about for company CEOs when they leave. So what this measure aims to do is put that power directly into the hands, or at least the power of oversight directly into the hands of the shareholders, and give them a little bit of wiggle room around what the compensation committees often do. But it doesn't give the government the power to legislate, for example, what the CEO of any major company makes.
Does Obama's position on this differ in any way from Clinton's or John McCain's?
So Senator Clinton has also has supported this measure. Senator McCain came out last week and said that he thought it was outrageous, some of the packages or some of the golden parachutes that you see coming out of corporate America. But I'm not sure whether or not he plans on voting for this particular bill. I think it is very politically in vogue right now. Especially for a candidate like the three who are running for the presidency, to stand up and make a statement on what's happening with some of the CEO pay. I think the interesting thing, though, is whether or not this question will come up on the campaign trail in Pennsylvania, especially given that that McCain and Senator Clinton have been in Congress for the last several years, certainly longer than Barack Obama has, and. One of the big criticisms of the last several years with the Bush administration being in power is there hasn't been as much oversight of companies. There's been very lax regulation of companies and the profits that they're making and how they're going about making some of those profits. So how genuine, the question becomes, well, how genuine a stance can either Senator Clinton or Senator McCain take, having been senators through this entire run where we've seen some of these really, really huge profits and really, really huge CEO packages?
Well, let's take a look at the issue of government involvement in big business from another angle, because with corporate giants going belly up, the federal government is getting some heat. You just mentioned some of that, for bailing out big corporations like Bear Stearns, Countrywide, and Merrill Lynch. Some are saying, though, if it's good for Wall Street, it should be good for Main Street. Can the same policy of shoring up business be used to shore up individuals in the manner that some are calling for, especially in the crippled housing mortgage crisis?
It's possible, but I think would you? There has to be some. You have to make some distinguish. You have to distinguish in some way between the person who is on Main Street, for example, who has made a conscious decision about the type of home they were buying, or who's in trouble because of some misbehavior financially on their own part, some poor decision making on their own part, and I think that the same you have to make. Some of that same distinguishing has to go on the corporate side. I mean, for example, you brought up the Bear Stearns rescue. Congress called in some officials from the administration a few weeks ago and asked directly the question, are we bailing out Bear Stearns to the detriment of the person who's on Main Street who could really use this help, especially when Bear Stearns is a huge investment bank, and these people are professionals. They know exactly what they're doing. Why are we spending the money to bail out this company? It's a big question, and I don't think there exists a magic bullet to fix both Wall Street and Main Street at this point in time. The situation that we're in economically in this country is the result of many, many things that happened over several years, and you're not going to find one button to push that fixes it all.
Final thing is this. We've got about a minute. Do you think that the bailout, and perhaps it's too early to determine, did it have to happen, and B, has it been effective?
I'm skeptical about whether or not it had to happen. We do know that if you take Bear Stearns' word for it, that there was a run on the bank and they had to, and that this needed to happen. But there are some questions about whether or not that happened, and at least the terms of the deal, whether or not it's going to work and whether or not it's going to help shore up the economy in the long run, I think remains to be seen.
Keith, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have been speaking with Keith Reed. He is a reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and he blogs for BET's finance page, Dollar Out of 15 Cents. He joined us from member station WGUC in Cincinnati, Ohio. And now for the most crucial economic news for today, at least, taxes. Tomorrow is tax day. Now, if you haven't done your taxes just yet, don't panic. We've called in an expert for some last-minute tax advice. Dwight Hunter is managing partner of Exodus Tax and Business Services. Dwight, welcome, and thanks for taking time out of what has to be a very busy day for you today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Taxes must be postmarked by tomorrow's date or e-filed by tomorrow midnight, but every year people wait until the very last minute to turn them in. What are some common mistakes people make when filing their taxes?
Well, the most common mistakes people make are math errors, actually. Incorrectly, and it doesn't compute with what the IRS records say it should be. That's probably the biggest mistake a lot of people make. After that, it's just missing things that, in honesty, they don't really have any way of knowing that they should be claiming, missed deductions, missed credits. And that's just from not knowing enough about their tax situation.
Now, if people listening to the show right now just realize that they have not done their taxes and that they are due tomorrow, what can they do right now to try to finish them on time, or is that even a good idea?
Well, the first thing I always tell people is calm down. Everybody falls into one of three categories. Either A, you are going to get a refund, in which case the deadline doesn't really apply to you. B, you're going to owe, but you actually can afford to pay it, so you're going to need to cut them a check and file an extension and take care of it as quickly as possible. And the third class of people are the ones who are usually the most nervous and upset about it, and that's the ones who think they owe and don't believe they can afford to pay it. Now, those people need to especially calm down and begin to take time to gather their documents so that they can possibly reduce that tax burden as much as possible.
Every year there are new deductions that people either don't know about or that they fail to take advantage of. There are some new ones for the 2000 tax year, but are any especially important to know?
Well, there are some energy credits out there, and credits are always better than deductions. So if you did some work on a home that made your home more energy efficient, you may qualify for energy credits. Also, people who drive hybrid cars may qualify for energy credits. There are also education credits out there. And there's one change that a lot of people don't know about with charitable contributions. Cash charitable contributions you used to did not have to provide as much documentation for, but the regulations have changed. So a lot of people who have been claiming a large amount of cash charitable donations need to be advised that the IRS may ask for documentation of that.
Here's my final question. We've got about a minute or so. Some people may not get their taxes filed in time by tomorrow. Some may not even file extensions, which would be a problem for them. But the question is this. The stimulus package, which is supposed to provide for citizens a rebate of sort for the government, you can't get that if you don't file your taxes, can you?
You absolutely have to file. And if you don't file by April 15th, that doesn't mean you won't get it. It just means it will be delayed. They'll process it as the returns are coming in. So it's always a good idea to file something because the penalties are worse for non-filers, and there's a good chance the IRS will prepare your taxes for you, which is the worst possible scenario.
Final thing, the government also goes after people who have even small amounts of money and taxes owed, don't they, if they don't pay?
If you don't pay, the penalties and interest begin to add up, so small amounts turn into large amounts rather quickly. And the IRS is, just like any other collection agency, they're really good and really persistent about taking all their remedies to get their money.
They want their money. Dwight Hunter, thank you so much. Dwight Hunter is managing partner of Exodus Tax and Business Services. He joined us by phone from his office in Atlanta. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Today on our Bloggers Roundtable, Tavis Smiley says goodbye to Tom Joyner's radio show, and the Democratic candidates exchange barbs over Obama's bitter comment. On today's Bloggers Roundtable, I am joined by Robert Redding, publisher of the RedingNewsReview.com, and Amber Nicole. She blogs at Nicola.com, and hopefully we'll be joined later by John McCann, who runs the blog Book of John. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Hello.
Let's start with Tavis Smiley. He is leaving the Tom Joyner show, but not until June. Now, some media reports have had him leaving the show immediately. Tavis says it's because he's juggling too many different projects, but some say, including Tom Joyner, that Tavis is calling it quits because of all the heat that he has drawn for criticizing Barack Obama. Robert, what do you think the real deal is?
Well, I think he can't handle the heat, so he's getting out of the kitchen. And I think that's unfortunate since, you know, to use an old saying, the chickens are kind of coming home to roost here with Tavis, because when you live on the Democratic plantation and you're drinking the Kool-Aid and it was coming out of both sides of your mouth and you're really touting Hillary Clinton as the premier candidate, I think at the end of the day, you have a situation where you're not being even-handed, and people are saying, you know what, we've had enough of the Clintons at this point. The Clintons have done a lot of good, but at the same time, they haven't done enough, and Barack Obama's our chance to get a black candidate, and people want to see that. So, I mean, the fact that he's not being independent and coming from an independent perspective, I think is showing through here in the fact that he's touting Hillary. I wouldn't be surprised if he goes and works for the Hillary campaign at some point.
Amber, you think this is more about politics than anything else? I mean, Clinton versus Obama?
I do to some extent. I have to say, I think Tavis Smiley was sort of a refreshing voice in the whole political discussion, just because not very many, prominent black leaders or media, individuals were speaking sort of against Obama. So I actually am a little bit disappointed to hear that he's moving on, but I do think it has a lot to do with politics. I think he's gotten a lot of flack from just sort of bringing some common sense into the discussion.
Well, you know, Tavis is someone that we all here at NPR know, myself included, having worked on the Tavis Smiley show when it was here at NPR. His suggestion then to you that he's just too busy with the TV show and the Forum for Black America and his foundation and all the other things that he's involved in. And he has been on the Tom Joyner show for 12 years, I think. You don't buy that, Robert?
Yeah, well, I don't buy it. And Tom Joyner made Tavis Smiley who he is, essentially, I think one can definitely argue. I'm not going to say that I quote-unquote think he's been a great voice. I mean, I think he's been a one-sided voice for the Democratic Party. I know you work with Tavis, and I understand that. I follow his career very closely. I'm an independent. I make that very clear. But when we're talking about politics here, we're talking about Hillary Clinton versus Barack Obama, we're talking about Tavis Smiley being strictly for Hillary Clinton. That's a bias that the listeners of the Tom Joyner Morning Show were not letting him get away with. Let's be clear about this and define our terms here.
You know, that's a very interesting situation, because politically, Amber, have you ever known an occasion
in which the black community has been rallied or has rallied itself in the way that it has to have an impact on or not being on the air surrounding something that was said or not said or support that was given or not given or criticism that was made or not made about a presidential candidate?
Not to this extent. I think we've seen it with other, you know, sort of within the political game with different comments that were made, but not on the extent of it being actually a presidential candidate. And I just wanted to also add that I don't think that you know, Tavis is not being completely forthright. I think what he's saying about having too many projects and having a lot that he's, you know, has going on, I think that's true, but I think this whole pressure that he's been receiving has sort of provided a reason to sort of move on. So I think it's a both and.
All right, so we should move on as well to topic number two for the Bloggers Roundtable. Senator Obama's campaign, we're going to talk about him a little bit more, spent the weekend dealing with fallout of his own from comments that he made about small-town Pennsylvania voters. During a private fundraiser in San Francisco last week, he said many Pennsylvania voters have been angry over the last 25 years because manufacturing jobs have left the region. And he said, quote, "I'm sure all of you have heard this by now. It is not surprising then they get bitter. They cling to guns or religion or antipathy toward people who aren't like them or anti-immigrant sentiment or anti-trade sentiment as a way to explain their frustrations." He has spent the weekend trying to explain away what he described as a poor choice of words. Robert, does he need to go? What does he need to do to get out from under this, or can he?
There is nothing to get off from under. He told the truth. The fact that white people in this country are losing their jobs and they are unemployed without hope of finding another job, with factories that have been shut down in their community for 25 years or more, with no hope of a new factory sprouting up anytime soon. I was talking to Joe Madison earlier today about this, and he was fielding phone calls about this, and he got nothing but white people that called his show. He's a black talk show host. Got nothing but white people that called his show saying, you know, Barack Obama's right here. Why is he apologizing? I think this makes him look weak. It's a bad move. I know people say that it contradicts his "yes, we can" message of optimism, but at the same time, before we can be optimistic about anything, we have to face the truth about where we are right now. And I think he was doing that, and then he apologized for something, and he's apologizing. Let's look at this. Why is he apologizing? Hillary Clinton, John McCain says he should, because he's attacking them. These comments really attack them and how they addressed and have addressed these issues in smaller America.
Let's welcome John McCain. He is joining us now. John McCain, who runs the blog Book of John. Hello, John.
Hey, what's going on, y'all?
Listen, one of the things I want to bring to you, talking about Obama and these comments, I was on the blog today from Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, and the whites that I read, here's what they had to say about Obama. They said, look, we go to church anyway. You know, we like our guns anyway, and we don't, it's not just because we lost our jobs and we are bitter. This is a part of our culture, and Obama needs to understand and recognize that. What about that, John?
Well, that's right. I mean, the man is telling me, and I'm a person of faith, you know, I'm a Christian, and, you know, is he telling me that I go to church because I need that as a crutch? Now, if he didn't have anything to apologize for, that's one thing, and I'll even grant you that. But the problem is, when is it going to come to a point where you stop playing politics, where you figure it's the political thing to do to issue an apology just to clean things up? When are these candidates going to stand for something?
That's an interesting point. And let me apologize for putting you in the presidential race, John McCain. You're not John McCain.
I've been saying
that name so much. It's just like in the back of my head.
Hey,
so
trust me. I'm a few shades lighter, and as well as my pockets is a whole lot lighter.
And a little bit younger, too, probably as well. So my apologies to you. Amber, let me come to you about this Obama thing, because here's a question. He's had some missteps recently on the campaign trail, the right controversy, of course, the typical white person comment, and now we have this one. How much of this can be blamed on his relative, I underscore the word relative, inexperience as a political campaigner on this stage?
I think probably a good deal can be. I think he's a great, he's got great rhetoric. He's probably the most skilled in terms of being a compelling speaker, but I think a lot of times that can sort of pull you too far in one direction, and you can often say things that came out, you know, the wrong way. I think if you've done any research on the state of Pennsylvania, you would know that, you know, there's a huge history behind why Pennsylvanians are the way that they are, and I think that that particular comment, if he's catching flack because of it, he should have and would have known that he could have said something different. But he knew what he was saying, and like others have stated, I think he needs to stand by his words.
Yeah, I mean, he's a guy who, you know, didn't he anyone that's saying that words matter, you know? So my thing is, if it was Hillary Clinton, if it was John McCain, this is a white guy, not me, if it was John McCain saying these things, he and so many others would have attacked. So fair is fair. Let's take off the kid gloves with Obama.
Talking sure. about taking off the kid gloves, both of them are in Pittsburgh today, Monday, trying really hard to win over voters. It's been said, Robert, that Philadelphia is Obama country and Pittsburgh is Clinton country and Pennsylvania was Clinton country, but it may be up for grabs now. How do you see it?
Well, Pennsylvania looks a lot like Mississippi in between Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. I still think it's a toss-up. I still think Hillary can do fairly well here. I think she has to do well to stay in this because I think Barack Obama has it really locked up at this point. But I think that those comments, back to those comments for a second, because I think those comments were really more for Indiana, which is where he looks to squeak out a victory. He's only down by a point or two in that industrialized state. And he needs to win an industrialized state at this point because of losing Texas and Ohio.
That's an interesting point. Let me just say to our listeners, you're listening to NPR's News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox, sitting in for Farai. If you're just tuning in with me on today's Bloggers Roundtable, Robert Redding, he publishes the RedingNewsReview.com, Amber Nicole, who blogs at Nicola.com, and John McCann, not John McCain, who runs the blog Book of John. Let's talk about Philadelphia more specifically, because the mayor there, Michael Nutter, recently signed a new gun control law, which has major restrictions. It would limit handgun purchases to one a month. It would require people to report lost or stolen weapons to police within 24 hours. And also, it outlaws the sale or possession of certain assault weapons. As you might imagine, the National Rifle Association and gun rights activists opposed the law. So my question, John, is will this new law help do anything to lower the already high crime rate and murder rate that they have there?
I don't think so. The thing is, just like when you make alcohol illegal with prohibition, folks still find a way to get their drink on. Just like if you marijuana is illegal, but you still see folks around here rolling blunts. So folks will find a way to get weapons and do the damage. I, as one of those Christians that Barack Obama says clings to their faith, would submit to you that the problem is a sin problem, and that until people's hearts change, legislation is not going to be the ultimate thing. Although, hey, you know, I do applaud the effort. You know, just like with civil rights, I applaud the efforts that were done and the legislation that was passed to change some things as far as race relations were concerned. But ultimately, it's a hard issue.
But there really are some serious issues with regard to the validity of this legislation, aren't there, Amber? Is it a Second Amendment issue, or is it just about the mayor trying to do something to stem a crisis hurting his city? And apparently, it goes against existing legislation passed by the state legislature.
I mean, I think that that's absolutely an issue here. I think that the validity of what the mayor is doing is definitely in question. But, I mean, if I had an organ right now, I'd pull it out because John McCann is over here preaching. I'm definitely in agreement with what he's saying because I think that although the intent of the mayor's heart might be correct, I don't think it's going to do a lot of, have any huge effect on the crime because it's a much, much bigger issue.
John, back in 2005, coming back to you once again, city residents voted 4-1 on a non-binding referendum demanding the state allow the city to pass its own gun laws. The state says it may, step in. Do you think that would be a good thing?
I don't know. I have to defer. I'm not up to speed on the gun laws, and so I would have to defer on that one.
Well, that's all right. Robert, what do you say about that?
Well, I think that it's definitely appropriate. Look, you know, at the end of the day, you know, the state can dictate what Philadelphia should be doing, but the mayor is the mayor of the city, and he has to try to deal with the problem at hand. I'm for the right to bear arms like everyone else just about in America, and the polls have shown this, but at the same time, within reason, do we really need folks walking the streets with AK-47s, especially where police are involved, and trying to police and put down some of these thugs and tyrants that are running the street?
You know, Hillary Clinton made passing reference to her support of both gun control and her support of people having the right to bear arms, but this hasn't really crept up into the national political debate for the presidency. Has it, and are you surprised at that, Amber?
A little bit surprised. I think it will eventually come, you know, come into the discussion. I think there have been so many other things that we've focused in on in the last, you know, 6 or so months. But it's a little bit surprising. But you know what? It's one of those pet issues that always has its way of coming up in conversation. I think it's just a matter of time.
Robert?
Well, I think that it probably will creep in, especially since D.C. is looking at very similar issues as it relates to guns.
All right, we're going to move away from guns and politics to something entirely different for our last couple of minutes of Bloggers Roundtable today. And it's about this person. Her name is Mariah Carey, and her hits just keep on coming.
Touch my body.
The pop star's latest tune, Touch My Body, has soared to the top of the Billboard Hot 100, making it her 18th number one single, and that alone pushes her to second place all time on the list past Elvis Presley. She is only second to the Beatles, who have 20 number one singles. John McCann, she has to compete with Ciara, Beyonce, Rihanna, all of these folks. Can she do it for another 5 years or so?
Well, I guess she can. I mean, you know, the kind of stuff she's singing about is nothing I would rush out and buy. If I could kind of tweak this discussion a little bit, and we could certainly bring it back. But, you know, congratulations to Mariah Carey. Okay, that's fine. But, guys, I'm still mad about the whole Michael Jackson thing. I still haven't heard the uproar.
Now, let me stop you there, because you're taking us on a left turn not going to have enough time to drive down that street. So let me come back. We'll visit that another time. Robert Redding, we're talking about Mariah Carey and this history-making moment for her.
I'm not in love with the single. I am in love with Mariah Carey. I have been for some time.
Surprise, surprise.
Just for the record. But let me just say that that's a nasty little song. If you've ever listened to the song, it really is a nasty little song. And I think she's holding her own against Ciara and the rest of those folks.
Amber, I'm going to give you the last word about this. What do you think about her making that place? And not so much about the song, but if you want to chime in on that, that's okay too.
I just have to say, I have a big sigh, and congratulations to Mariah, but I just wish she would go back to the days when she would just stand in her black dress and sing with the microphone. I think she's too old to be singing these kind of songs.
Well, with that, we're going to bring Bloggers Roundtable to an end. John, Amber, Robert, thank you very much for being with us again.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. African Americans make up about 13% of the U.S. population, yet they control less than 1% of the nation's TV stations. The state of radio is not much better. Who loses out when the people who control the airwaves don't reflect their audiences? NPR's Farai Chidea recently asked Crystal Brent Zook. Her new book, I See Black People, profiles some African Americans who have managed to own radio and TV outlets. Crystal says she hopes the book will remind people that black broadcast ownership is in crisis.
If you look at it more closely, there are a lot of sort of small and medium-sized African American owners all throughout the country who over the last 30 years have just been struggling to maintain their one or two or three stations, and many of them have lost that battle, and the numbers are not good, and we are almost to the point where minority ownership is non-existent, and in many, many markets it already is. So the question is, should this matter to us? And I think all the evidence shows that, yes, it definitely makes a difference and it should matter.
When you say all the evidence shows that it makes a difference, what do you point to? What makes it make a difference?
Well, even the FCC's own research showed that local owners do a better job of covering the news, and they do a better job of serving their local communities. Because local owners tend to be small and minority owners and also women owners, they're included in that group. A few years ago, when the study was done, the FCC decided not to publish the results and to basically deep six the findings, as Barbara Boxer put it. And Senator Boxer was the one who, you might remember a little while ago, it was leaked to her, these studies that the FCC had done, and she made it public. So we might not have even known about this if it hadn't surfaced.
You profile many individuals who own media and run programming, both on radio and television. And one of the profiles that may be surprising to some people who even follow African-American media is Chauncey Bailey, who is now sadly known as someone who was slain while doing his job as a reporter in Oakland. But tell us about his broadcast history as well.
Yeah, Chauncey Bailey, many people knew him as just a hardworking, crusading journalist who was always for his community in Oakland. But a lot of people didn't realize that he had strong ties to cable access and television access for African Americans, and that Oakland was really a leader in this. They had the first black-owned and controlled cable, local access cable station in the country, I believe, and that was Soulbeat TV. It was founded in the 1970s, even before BET. They did, you know, mostly show music videos, but over the years it provided an outlet for community issues to be heard. Chauncey Bailey was actually news director there for 8 years, and when it went away, single-handedly was responsible for resurrecting its tradition, and he founded a new local cable access station called Our TV, which was the successor to Soulbeat.
Now, one of the biggest kahunas is Kathy Hughes, and she's got a network, Radio One. However, just a few days ago, we heard that Radio One was going to sell its L.A. station, leaving it with no presence in this huge radio market. What do you see for Radio One and Kathy Hughes?
Kathy Hughes is another early pioneer in this. You know, if you go back to her roots, she bought her first station, WOL, in Washington, D.C., and she bought it because of some of the government policies that had recently been put in place to help minority investors. So we kind of have to look back and say, would she even be this huge billionaire presence today if those policies hadn't been put in place? She was able to buy it from the Washington Post, I believe, under the distress sale policy, which was geared towards minority ownership. Radio One is the largest African-American radio network, but still, they only have about 54 stations. So if you compare it to something like a Clear Channel, which has just completely monopolized the industry with 1,200 stations, it's relatively small.
So what do you think lies ahead in terms of ownership? And put it in the context of this digital world where you have so much distribution now happening, not over radio airwaves or even through cable television, but through a very different set of rules that operate on the net.
There is a large movement for net neutrality in place. People are really concerned about that issue. I haven't looked at that as closely yet, just because I do think that the majority of Americans still get their news from television and specifically from local newscasts. And so I do think that local commercial television ownership is still a hugely important issue, and it's still being one that's being fought. Right now there's a Senate resolution. The Bush administration continues to support further relaxation, as they say, of the rules, meaning that the big owners can continue to get bigger and own more and more of the pie. we have basically five major media companies owning just about everything already in this country. So as you continue to relax these rules, you really continue to squeeze out small and local owners more and more. We've seen a 35% decrease in the number of radio station owners just in the last 20 years. Minority ownership has fallen by at least, 14-15%, and continuing to decline. And, this isn't just an African-American issue. I'm talking about all people of color who make up 35% of the population own about 3% of TV stations. That's a huge disparity. And if you want to look at women owners who are, more than 50% of the population, women of all races own about 5% of TV stations. So what kind of perspectives are we not getting when you don't have diversity in ownership? The FCC has sort of been forced to acknowledge, yes, diversity makes a difference, but they've failed to do anything about it.
Well, Crystal, thank you so much.
Thank you, Farai.
Crystal Brent Zook is the author of the book, I See Black People, The Rise and Fall of African-American-Owned Television and Radio. She joined us from NPR's New York Bureau.
That was NPR's Farai Tudeha, who returns as host tomorrow. It was just after noon on May 3, 1946. 16-year-old Willie Francis sat strapped to gruesome Gertie, the traveling electric chair that was visiting St. Martinville, Louisiana that day. Francis had been sentenced to die by an all-white jury for a murder he claimed he did not commit. The executioner threw the switch. Francis contorted and cried out, but he didn't die. Local officials wanted to send him right back to the chair, but Willie fought his double jeopardy all the way to the United States Supreme Court. He lost. 1 year and 6 days later, Willie Francis was strapped down in that chair again and electrocuted on May 9, 1947. Joining me now is Gilbert King. He has written a book called The Execution of Willie Francis, Race, Murder, and the Search for Justice in the American South. Welcome, Gilbert.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, sir. A few years ago, a documentary on the Francis case came to light. It was called Willie Francis Must Die Again. Why did you decide to take on the Willie Francis story as well?
Well, I thought there were some interesting things that never really came up, especially in Willie's trial. His trial was basically a travesty of justice. He had two public defenders who were Cajun. The judge was Cajun. There were 12 jurors who were Cajun. These public defenders didn't cross-examine any witnesses and didn't call any of their own witnesses. And when the prosecution rested their case, these gentlemen stood up and said, "We rest our case too." And so it only took the jury 15 minutes to convict Willie. So there really wasn't a lot of information in the trial. But one thing I found was a confession that was obtained without an attorney around. And Willie wrote 8 mysterious words in that confession that always caught my eye. And I always thought there was something more to this story. He wrote, "It was a secret about me and him." And that never came up in the trial. It never came up in any appeal. It was sort of brushed under in St. Martinville, and nobody wanted to talk about it.
What did it mean?
Well, it was interesting. The prosecution tried to allege that this was a random stick-up, they said, that he tried to rob this pharmacist. But really, it wasn't random. It was a crime of passion. These two knew each other. Willie admitted to knowing each other. They had a relationship in St. Martinville. Willie worked with him. I found witnesses who said, he hired him. He was working, doing yard work. So they definitely knew each other. And Andrew Thomas was sort of this mysterious bachelor who lived a little bit outside of town. And he was loved by everybody in the community, but he was always rumored to be sort of, one of those guys down south that nobody really knew too much about. And so, obviously, when police asked Willie, "Why'd you do it, Willie?" he wrote, "It was a secret about me and him," and he would never discuss it.
Let me ask you about the execution, the two executions, the first failed one and the second one that ultimately was successful and took Willie Francis's life. How did this case change people's views on capital punishment at the time?
Well, at the time, when the first time Willie survived the chair, it was a huge headline story. You can imagine in April of 1947, this is a time when Jackie Robinson is breaking into the major leagues, first black to ever play professional baseball. And yet, I was looking through the headlines, a Chicago Defender, a Pittsburgh Courier. The large headline across the banner was "Last Chance for Willie." And this is at the same time as Jackie Robinson breaking in. So this really captured the public attention. And I think why people looked at it differently was that people may not have had strong feelings one way or the other about the death penalty, but when it came to somebody who woke up in the morning, went to the electric chair and did their part, and because of two drunken executioners, they didn't die, people thought that's unfair and that he should not have to go back to the chair. And that's what really captured America's interest.
Is the case important now because of its connection to any current cases or current law?
Well, it is, because they don't really, the Supreme Court does not really have too many decisions about cruel and unusual punishment. The last one was this particular case, the Willie Francis case. Right now, there's a case called Bays versus Reese, and this is to decide whether the drug cocktail and lethal injection is considered cruel and unusual. So it doesn't come up very often in history. Only a handful of times has the Supreme Court heard arguments on this.
You know, and looking at the book, which was fascinating, and the photographs that you were able to get through your research are just mind-boggling, and the one that I have in front of me now shows Willie on the way to the executioner's chair, and he's dressed up in nice slacks because he said he wanted to look nice when he saw the Lord. But what caught me was the expression on this man's face, who was going back to the death chamber, and yet he doesn't look worried, concerned, fearful at all.
Well, you know, what was really struck me about this story is Willie had such remarkable courage, and there's the sort of the survival of his spirit. You know, it's a story of humanity in the face of inhumanity. He was the one who was calming his attorneys. He was calming his families. He was ready for death. And he was the only person in the world who knew exactly what it was like to go to the electric chair, because he survived it. And so I think his dignity and the things that he used to say, he was very poetic in his speaking. And, you know, even though he described the first trip to the chair as being plumb miserable, and he had a terrific stutter, but he was still very poetic, and a lot of newspapers called attention that, you know, here's this calm kid who speaks so beautifully.
Here's my final thing. We have about a minute. The town has been cursed in a sense, hasn't it? Not because of this, but this is one example of the curse, isn't it?
Exactly. Strangely enough, St. Martinville had another execution 50 years before Willie's, in which an innocent man was hanged in town square. And the last thing he said to the people was, there's people watching me right now go to my death who know that I'm innocent. And when he fell from the scaffold, they had too much rope, and his feet touched the ground. And what happened was the sheriff dug a hole under his feet until he strangled to death. And the last thing he did was put a curse on St. Martinville. And so a lot of people thought when Willie went to the electric chair and survived that the town really was cursed.
Gilbert King, I want to thank you very much for coming on and sharing your insights with us. Gilbert King is author of the new book, The Execution of Willie Francis, Race, Murder, and the Search for Justice in the American South. He joined us from NPR's New York City Bureau.
Welcome to Atlanta, where the players play, and we ride on them things like every day. Big beats hit streets, see gangsters roaming, and parties don't stop till 8 in the morning.
Welcome to Atlanta, where the players play, and we ride on them things like every day. Big beats hit streets.
For the rest of this week, News and Notes will be broadcasting from Atlanta, Georgia. Host Farai Chidea is there now, working on a couple of stories. She's on the line to tell us what she's up to. Hey, Farai.
Hey, Tony.
So, Farai, give our audience a preview of what's coming up on the rest of the week with the shows you're putting together down there.
We have an extremely exciting lineup. We are talking to Mayor Franklin, who was named one of the best mayors in America. And she's got a tough challenge. She's got 20 months left in her term. She says she's not going to run again. And there's a $65 million budget shortfall. There's a drought in Atlanta. The housing market is doing not well, as is true with the rest of the country. But she is one tough, smart lady. And so we're going to really get an inside look at the politics of the city. We're also going to speak with a congressman. We're going to speak with some hip-hop artists. We're going to talk to youth organizers. We're going to talk to the Africans and Caribbeans who help make up this city and see how they interact with the folks who were born in the United States, because immigration is a big issue here, just like it is in the rest of the country.
Now, you're also going to do a big town hall live show on Friday, right?
we're doing two. We're doing Wednesday and Friday. And this is a real format breaker for us because we usually do the show in the studio. And we're going to have a live audience. They're going to have a chance to interact with the guests. And I just want to give a special shout-out to our host here, WCLK, that's out of Clark, Atlanta, a historically black college, and Georgia Public Broadcasting. So we have really had a huge partnership here as well.
That sounds great. Tell me, how is Atlanta right now? What's it like down there?
Well, you know, they call it Hotlanta, and it is 46 degrees. People here, their fingers are turning blue. No one is wearing a winter coat because they're expecting it to be in the 70s, and people don't know what to do with themselves.
Sounds like it's going to be a very interesting week. Can't wait to hear the rest of the week.
Oh, thanks, Tony.
See you, Farai.
Bye.
That was News and Notes host Farai Chidea speaking with us from Atlanta. The show will be broadcasting from Atlanta for the rest of the week. That's our show for today. Thanks for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. No spaces, just nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for the newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, we're broadcasting from Atlanta, Georgia. We'll take a look at what life is like for African and Caribbean immigrants who have moved to that southern Mecca. I'm Tony Cox. This is News and Notes.